Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
It is the Awful Announcing Podcast, another roundtable edition here in the month of April. Welcome in. Ben Heisler with you. The Awful Announcing Podcast is, of course, presented by our good friends over at Clip It. You download the Clip It app today on Android or iOS. It's the number one way to share your favorite clips amongst your friends, family, whoever you might like. Joining us on the roundtable today is Andrew Buckles, frequent contributor to the roundtable. What's up, Andrew?
Not too much. Thanks for having me.
And Matt Yoder is back with us today as well. How are you, Matt?
I'm glad to take 30 minutes away from my crippling Fortnite addiction to be with you guys for this podcast tonight.
Well, don't let us stop you. Andrew and I can just keep going for a while if you really need to get back.
All right, I'll be honest.
NBA players there, Matt? Or are you in the cool people leagues?
I am the world's worst Fortnite player. But it is way too addicting to give up.
I feel like Fortnite is like Pokemon Go in the sense of, like, I'm going to be way too late to this party to have any idea of what's going on. Like, I don't know anything about Fortnite. Nothing.
I have had people then 30 years younger than me and 30 years older than me talking about Fortnite and how it is taking over the world. So there is no stage in which it will be too late to jump in.
Okay. It's kind of like HQ in the sense of, like, it's bringing people across all generations together in hopes of trying to outsmart Scott Rogowski.
Very much so. Okay. And there's nothing that's a better pick-me-up than having a 12-year-old trash talk you over Xbox while they're hacking you to death with a pickaxe.
But that's been a tradition that's been going on for years. That doesn't have to be just with Fortnite.
That is true.
Let's start with the NBA and the NHL playoffs on this roundtable. And the early numbers have come in, and both of the early numbers for ratings have both the NBA and the NHL up. And that's exciting because they're going to be, I think, a pretty remarkable set of postseason games. You already saw it so far in the NBA with that first game going on with Cleveland and Indiana, with the Pacers just rushing Cleveland out the door. New Orleans has taken a 2-0 lead on the road against Portland. But a lot of people are, especially in the Western Conference, are expecting some pretty competitive series. So I will start with you, Andrew. From both of these early numbers, and I guess we can start on the NBA side, are you anticipating these numbers remaining above the levels that we initially expected?
Yeah, I think the NBA numbers are going to be pretty good. I think we've already seen some improvement there. I think it's been interesting that we've seen that improvement despite a bunch of the injuries, that despite not having a guy like Kyrie Irving, despite not having a guy like Gordon Hayward, people still care about the teams that are left. They care about the players that are left. Even with Steph Curry not being there, there's still a lot of interest in the Warriors. And there's still some pretty compelling storylines. So I think it's going to be pretty good. The one thing I am really interested to see, though, is how this plays out with the Toronto Raptors, who, of course, are always complaining about how they're not getting prime games, they're not getting prime locations. Well, and a big part of that's because they don't have a U.S. local market. And this is a year where they finished with the best record in the Eastern Conference. They could theoretically make quite a run. I mean, they've already won game one for the first time in 17 years. They've got their first 2-0 lead ever. Mm-hmm. So if they keep doing well and they keep winning, I'm interested to see if that brings down the ratings the way you would expect, or if people sort of get behind that storyline, even if they're not from Toronto.
And a nice playoff-driven matchup with Washington that's got stars in their own right. What about you, Matt?
I kind of compare it to the NCAA tournament in a way, because this is the first year in a long time where there's been this much uncertainty when it comes to the NBA playoffs. I mean, for how many years have we just basically penciled in Cleveland and Golden State in the final? And there's a sense of inevitability about it. I mean, every year you look at the NBA playoffs and there's maybe, what, two, three, gosh, some crazy years, it's four teams that could win. Well, now you can make the case for a lot of different teams and a lot of different combinations advancing to the conference finals or the finals. But it's like the NCAA tournament in that the uncertainty and the competition and the deep series, the unpredictability, that's great in the early rounds. But you can bet that when it comes time for crunch time, CBS and Turner, they want Duke, they want North Carolina, right. They want Kentucky, they want those big programs of the Final Four. Same thing with the NBA, and no disrespect to the Raptors, but ABC and ESPN, they want Cavs Warriors. They probably settle for Cavs Rockets,
right?
But they're going to want those big teams there at the end. You know, if it's Pelicans Raptors, that could go down as one of the lowest rated NBA finals in history. So it's great to a point, and I mean, basketball purists, just as fans, I think, hey, Pelicans-Raptors would be awesome. I mean, you get two new teams in there, Anthony Davis, DeMar DeRozan, you can build some stars there, but it's just not going to draw on the casual fans that you would if those super, super, super stars are there at the end. So I think the leagues are definitely happy now, but we'll see how that goes as we go through the next couple months.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say the stars are certainly one aspect of it, but I think the markets are even more important. And New Orleans is interesting there in that they've got one of the NBA's best stars in Anthony Davis, but they have a tiny TV market. They've got one of the smallest markets in North American professional sports in terms of TV households. And so I think their ratings are an interesting one to keep an eye on, too, along with Toronto, just because it's a team, like, there's, from a basketball perspective, there's a lot of interesting things going on there. There's Anthony Davis, there's Boogie Cousins, there's so on. But and they're a fun team to watch, but they don't have that massive amount of local area to draw from. And we see this in not just the NBA, but in all sorts of sports. We see it in the NHL, we see it in MLB. A lot of the ratings for any championship or any playoff game come from that local area. And so that makes it really tough if you get the smaller market teams advancing.
But and if it is encouraging for the NBA, they've been up, the ratings have, throughout the entire season. And we've spent a lot of time on the podcast talking about the challenges when it comes to the NFL, the Olympics. I mean, you go deeper, look at NASCAR's ratings. There are few sports out there that are actually seeing consistent television growth, and the NBA is one of them. So hats off to them that they seem to be thriving right now. And I just – this is my worldview. I think you have to give some credit to the league for being so forward-thinking when it comes to YouTube and social media,
yes.
How they've marketed themselves, how they've made the league so accessible. And you look at the NFL and Major League Baseball, who maybe don't have that same accessibility, who try to take the copyright strikes and everything down and everything so restricted. Is it a wonder that the NBA, who has been by far the most open league in this age of social media, is it a wonder that we see their audience growing while others are shrinking?
I think that's a terrific point, and I'm glad you brought that up. And Jeff Passan, my buddy over at Yahoo Sports, wrote a really good article about the ban of Pitching Ninja over on Twitter and how that process is likely going to be unfolded and turned down. But you're right. The NBA has embraced the sharing of its content through social media, and they've done it in a way in which they understand the benefit there. Yeah, is it without the express written consent of the National Basketball Association? Of course, but it's still within the best interest of the NBA growing and being shared with a younger audience. And that's the biggest thing about the NFL and the and Major League Baseball and golf. And I talked about that a couple weeks ago on the Awful Announcing podcast, that so many sports are on the trajectory of losing so many younger viewers, that this is one fairly easy way that you're trying to win the battle but ultimately losing the war. And it's something that a lot of the other sports could learn a considerable amount from. I want to go back to something that you guys said with regards to the markets and the rating size, because I don't know if I necessarily agree. I think in the NBA, predominantly with Cleveland, that's not necessarily a major market. And sure. In Philadelphia, I don't think is necessarily a draw by means of market size, but merely by storyline and by narrative. This is a team that was atrocious for several years. Then all of a sudden you start trusting the process. Joel Embiid turns into a top 10 NBA player, if not better. The team collectively goes from first to a top 3 seed and beats out Cleveland. Like there's dominant markets and teams, but I think the storyline surrounding them might actually be substantially better than the actual markets they're in. Am I wrong?
Well, and well, I wonder... Yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
Sorry, I think that's true to an extent, but Philadelphia is the fourth largest TV market in the U.S., so I mean, I don't think you can't really consider them to be too far down on
no,
this.
No, but I think my point is, though, is that if Philadelphia was... I don't know if I can say Milwaukee, but let's say Philadelphia was Detroit And I understand Detroit's still like a top eight, top 10 market, but I think the storyline would be the same. You have these this collection of characters, and the NBA wants Cleveland back in it because of LeBron. I think it's sort of in a similar trajectory as what the NFL gets, where it's star-driven and not necessarily market-driven.
Yeah, I mean, I'd certainly agree with that, and I think that's that's an interesting point relative to what you guys were talking about the NBA embracing GIFs, embracing clips on social media, and so on. I think another thing that the NBA really embraces is the personalities of its players, and that's in a whole wide range of areas. It's from them commenting on politics to them doing goofy things like Joel Embiid wearing a Phantom of the Opera mask and like complaining on Instagram that the team isn't playing him yet. When it comes to like Lakers rookies playing Fortnite and committing tampering violations while they're doing it and so on, right? Like the NBA and beyond that to even more controversial things like commenting on politics, commenting on President Trump and so on. And the NBA, I do think, really does embrace personalities of its stars in an interesting way. There's a lot of interest in its stars' lives, as you can see from even like the ratings for something like Ball and the Family, which is very little to do with the NBA,
right,
other than like one of the guys is in it. But there's so much interest in a lot of these guys, in a lot of these guys as players, as personalities, and they're really, they're not afraid to show it, and teams aren't getting down on them for it. And then you compare that to the NFL, where you get things like all the draft talk about, oh, we can't take Josh Rosen because he might tweet about the president at one point, right? Like, I mean, the NFL is so determined to, like, crush all of its players into this soulless good team guy mold. And I think that really is hurting it in the way that, and the opposite is really helping the NBA.
Well, and I wonder, you know, it'd be interesting to see, because the NBA has been so LeBron centric for so long. And now obviously you have the Warriors in there and Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, all those guys. How would a James Harden Houston be able to draw? How would Philadelphia and Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, how would they be able to? I'd almost be curious to see, like, what would a Houston-Philly final series do for the NBA? I just think it'd be fun to kind of go through that for the first time and see who those guys would be that would be next. Because LeBron, I mean, he's in the latter half of his career, we think. I mean, gosh, he's superhuman, so who knows how long he's going to go on for. But it would be very interesting to me to see who those next waves of guys are and teams. I mean, Houston is a big market, and yet you never really hear them in the conversation. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fascinating because those are big cities. But, you know, in the NBA, does it come down to L.A., New York, and then everybody else? And we know the Knicks and Lakers aren't getting back to the finals anytime soon. Even Boston sometimes now, especially without Kyrie Irving, is flying really far under the radar. So that's why there's so many intricate storylines in these NBA playoffs. They are very fascinating. But I think the best news for the NBA probably is that none of their playoff games at least are on Golf Channel. So they do have that going.
I'm also glad you brought that. I'm glad you brought that up. And Andrew, I know that you might want to go off on this a little bit. But what the hell is NBC Sports doing? Is it just a means of just not planning ahead well? Or is this another way to try and show that there's all these different platforms that they offer? Like, what was the reason behind NBC Sports putting playoff games on the Golf Channel?
Yeah, well, one last NBA thing real quick. It's just that it's interesting that the ratings are up. Matt mentioned that there is no New York, there is no LA. And this is the first time since the Lakers moved west that there's no New York, LA, or Chicago teams in the NBA playoffs. And that those are the three biggest TV markets in the U.S. So it's pretty amazing that the NBA playoffs are up because of that, despite that. And that really maybe speaks to some of those points about stars and storylines. But the Golf Channel thing is fascinating with the NHL. And what that is really about, it seems to be from the reporting anyway, from what Kevin Allen wrote in USA Today, is that it's not about what NBC Sports wants. It's about what the people who run CNBC and USA want. And they apparently decided that they can get better ratings with their existing programming, which in USA's case is almost certainly true, is they have a new episode of Suits. And Suits has fallen off in the ratings, but even The last two episodes are the lowest rated it's drawn this year. It's still drawing way more than NHL playoff games. It's pulling in about 900,000 viewers at the lowest, whereas some of the best NHL games so far have drawn about 650,000, 700,000 or so. So there's a strong case for not shuffling suits off in favor of an NHL game, especially when it's not the night's marquee NHL game. The CNBC thing is a little more interesting, as they're running reruns of Shark Tank, and then they're running Staten Island Hustle, this new show. And so neither of that is necessarily
all. And who among us isn't a religious viewer of Staten Island Hustle? I know that's the first thing on my DVR.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I'm going to watch right after this. But no, there's an argument that the NHL would draw better than those reruns. However, it's not necessarily going to draw better. Shark Tank reruns do pretty well. A game on CNBC last Wednesday only drew about 250,000 viewers. So it's not really, it's not like this is great top tier programming. It's also not like it's the only NHL programming on the night. As you'd expect, NBCSN has back-to-back games. So this is getting, it's getting people from the local markets, although not all of them, because the local networks are still carrying NHL games in the first round, so they can still tune into those networks for the home coverage. So it's getting a few national fans who don't want to watch the other games. It's not exactly like must-see programming, and that's a big part of why USA and CNBC have decided not to do this, and so they ship it on over to Golf Channel. Now, I mean, that's probably a good thing for Golf Channel. It gets some people to pay attention to them. It makes more sense in putting it on NHL Network, because Golf Channel is much wider distribution. It's in over 70 million homes. But it is a big step down from USA's 91 million and CNBC's 86 or so million. And so it's not a great thing for the NHL. It's a little embarrassing for them. It's unfortunate for fans who want to watch this and don't have Golf Channel. But from the perspective of the people running each of these channels, it's probably not a terrible programming decision.
Andrew, please tell me we're going to track the reaction of Golf Channel fans on Twitter who are apoplectic over seeing hockey.
Where's my golf
on their network? I mean, we know how they reacted to Chris Berman during the U.S. Open all those years. What will they do when they see a hockey game on their channel? I just wonder, though, does this represent a strain in the relationship between NBC and the NHL?
They that's what I was going to bring up.
Such good partners for each other over the years, and it just seems to me there's been some signs of strain there.
Well, they kind of needed each other, though, right? They've needed each other.
Well, you know, the regular season, I know the playoff ratings have been up, but it's been weird. NBA, you can look at that across the board. Regular season NHL, not quite as strong as they were at their peak with NBC. There's the whole controversy with the Olympics. Were they going to show NHL games during the Olympics? Was NBC mad that the league pulled out of the Olympics? What was the priority there? You've got ESPN kind of dipping their toes back into the water ever so gingerly, more and more with the NHL. So I just wonder, are we seeing some signs of strain there when you have these major NBC cable networks saying, you know what, we're just going to take some reruns of our normal stuff instead of doing the hockey thing again? Are they thinking that it's run its course? Does the NHL need to think about their long-term future? I don't know, because for so many years, that has been such a beneficial partnership for both sides.
All right, we got to move on, but I there's a 5% portion of me that wants the NHL rights to go back to Fox purely to get the hockey puck on fire. That's the only reason I want it back. And I wonder if they'd actually consider it, because, you know, they might.
If Roseanne can make a comeback, why not the puck?
Well, and then we'll have the same argument of, why are games not on FS1? Why are they on Fox Business Channel?
with the halftime show, they bring back Bill O'Reilly to do intermission. he can just fight Mike Milbury the entire time.
Lou Dobbs and Mike Milbury actually would be a very, very interesting combo.
Yeah, that would be a something. That'd be a something. Speaking of large men, did you guys watch the Andre the Giant documentary? That was outstanding on HBO, and I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts on I think it was Bill Simmons' real last documentary project, at least for now, but it was one of the better ones that I had seen, and I think it was beneficial to anybody that either was a huge wrestling fan, and I'm somebody that wasn't, but understanding his story from sort of beyond this mythical figure in The Princess Bride, which is kind of how I knew Andre the Giant, to sort of seeing where he ultimately went to, I thought the documentary was incredibly well done. Matt, what about you?
I mean, as a wrestling guy, as someone, you know, very familiar with the story of Andre the Giant, I thought it was an awesome documentary. And they covered so much of his life, from the legendary drinking tales away from the ring and some of his feats that could only be conceived of by the imagination. Then they touched on his WWF days and kind of his career culminating in WrestleMania III, which pretty much everyone knows about, going up against Hulk Hogan and how he fought through that and what he went through outside of the ring, just with his physical condition, with living as an actual giant in real life and what that was like, you know, getting kind of that peek behind the curtain at the real Andre the Giant was fascinating. But I thought, even for the non-wrestling fan, the documentary did such a good job to welcome you into that world, to explain the territory days and how someone like Andre the Giant could go from town to town, territory to territory, and basically be this traveling show and experience. That this wasn't a guy that you could put out in the same city night after night for years on end, that this was an experience to watch Andre the Giant that you'd never forget, and how he preserved that special quality over all those years, because wrestling's very different these days. I mean, you've got WWE that is a worldwide dominant brand. You've got the indie scene that is still alive and well. You see promotions like New Japan, Lucha Underground. They, you know, are making kind of an imprint in the United States, but it's pretty much WWE and then everyone else. So to take you inside of that world of pro wrestling back in the glory days, and how Andre the Giant was such a huge deal and really laid the groundwork for what would come later, I thought it was great storytelling. And guys, this is what Bill Simmons should have been doing for HBO all along.
That's right. Yeah.
Is shows like this, because that was really, really well done.
He did a terrific job. I don't want to give away too much, but there's a scene within the documentary where they're talking about what it was like when Andre the Giant had to travel cross country. And not just cross country, but across the entire world. And, you know, what would happen to Andre the Giant on an 18-hour flight, and just sort of watching and understanding the realization of what this person had to go through in those types of situations was remarkable. And also understanding what happened when he had his heel turn moment. That, to me, were two of the biggest takeaways from that. But let's go back to the world of documentaries one more time. You have ESPN going forward with ESPN Plus, and they're moving the Bob Knight documentary to ESPN Plus. But we're so used to these constant announcements of what's happening, what's the latest 30 for 30, and there really hasn't been much of it. And if you listen to James Andrew Miller's podcast, you know that there was a whole section of their 30 for 30s and Simmons' role and impact on them, and how that's it went away from it and then came back to it, and now they're kind of looks like they're going away from it. Andrew, do you anticipate ESPN getting back into the 30 for 30 game and doing it on a more consistent level?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough. I think they've done almost 100 of these at this point. They've covered a lot of the real big topics, a lot of the real obvious ones, and a lot of the things that have just built-in fan bases for it. And I think they've done some really good 30 for 30s about smaller subjects, but those haven't always found the giant audience. I think with a lot of these, the audience of people willing to sit down and watch it is people who already have an interest in the specific person or in the specific sport or some way forward for more 30 for 30s. I think maybe we'll get more of them premiering there. They're going to need to put a lot of content on that to keep it subscribers. The 30 for 30s are probably one of the most appealing things on there at this point, and it's nice that they've brought over that whole library to ESPN Plus. And I think that's a spot where you can do some new ones. You can do some ones on maybe more obscure topics. And even if it doesn't necessarily get as big of an audience as something that airs on linear TV, you can justify it by saying, hey, this is the content that's going to be on ESPN Plus. This is why you need to sign up and sort of get subscribers in that way. So I think there is less appeal to them in doing a lot of the big traditional 30 for 30s in prominent spots on ESPN, but I think that there may be more room for more of them on ESPN Plus.
Is that the direction you see them going in as well, Matt?
You know what it reminds me of is so many years ago, and we were talking back in the Stone Age, back when ESPN2 first came around in the mid-90s, and ESPN put a UNC Duke game on ESPN2. And I remember, even as a kid, like, I mean, elementary school age, that was such a big deal at the time. I was like, holy cow, they're putting this on this weird Deuce channel? Like, what is that about? And that's what it kind of reminds me of, that ESPN is going to try to push as much content within reason as they can to ESPN Plus to try to build that service up. But I don't know how smart it is in the long run, just because what ESPN has built with 30 for 30 in their documentaries, I might even argue that it's now currently the brand that resonates the most for the network beyond SportsCenter. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has been so far and wide-reaching, so well-received, that I think you've just got to keep going with it. And it's something to me that, you know, even my friends, like, we don't talk about SportsCenter anymore, but the Ric Flair documentary or whatever documentary comes along, you bet we're talking about this. Man, did you see this? Like, did you watch this? Oh, I've got it on DVR. Like, people are excited about these documentaries. And when it comes to the sports world, there are an unlimited number of stories that you can tell with those documentaries. So if anything, I think ESPN should be ramping up what they do with 30 for 30 in their documentaries instead of dialing back in any way.
I think something that's also interesting there, though, is there's maybe more competition for them now, especially when it comes to landing the big marquee directors. We've seen a number of guys who have worked with ESPN on 30 for 30s, like Jason Hare, who did the Andre the Giant one. He's now doing that with HBO. We've seen guys like Jonathan Hawk, who's done 30 for 30s. Now he's doing some stuff with SITV. We're seeing SITV get into that space. We're seeing Uninterrupted get into that space a little bit with some features, some documentary-ish things like 89 Blocks. Fox Sports has gone in there a little bit, partnering on 89 Blocks and so on. And you see, like, Netflix occasionally says they want to do some sports stuff, and if they're going to do sports stuff, it's going to be, like, movies and documentaries versus live games. I mean, I think the sports documentary is a very compelling piece of content, and especially for a streaming service, because it's something that can live on forever, be watched on demand whenever somebody wants it. And so it's got that sort of long tail that Netflix and Amazon and the like are looking for. But I think the challenge for ESPN is, A, a lot of those directors are going and doing it elsewhere, and then B, it's finding things that still do have enough broad appeal to justify putting it on main ESPN and justify investing a lot of time and resources into it. The thing to keep in mind there too, and this has sort of come up with a lot of stuff with ESPN recently, is you have to remember the time when 30 for 30 launched, how it launched like 09, 010, and so on, and how it got really big in the years after. Well, that was when ESPN was spending money on absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. When they were the dominant player, there was no signs of weakness whatsoever. They're the sports network. And then the last couple of years have been budget cuts, layoffs, slashing things here, left, right, and there. So I think they're in an era where they really have to be able to justify content expenditures more than they ever have. And I think you can still do that with some 30 for 30s. I think with the right one, it can be a good play for main ESPN. With some smaller ones, you can use it, well, this is how we're going to get people to sign up for ESPN Plus. But I think they really have to justify them in a way that they didn't back when this started. And that makes it hard.
That's a really, really interesting point. The idea of expanded revenue, especially as more people go away from a traditional cable package, whether or not you can justify the ends to continue to make a lot of these documentaries, which would be a shame because of the impact that they had. And you guys discussed it, this was sort of the foundation, and you mentioned a lot of these directors are now going to other channels doing similar work that ESPN really sort of laid the foundation for. I guess maybe HBO did initially, but ESPN turned it on its head and really created a whole new level to it. I want to get you guys out of here on this. One other thing on ESPN at the beginning of the month was the debut of Get Up with Mike Greenberg, Michelle Beadle, Jalen Rose, amongst other casts of characters. I remember turning it on one morning and there was like six people on the set and I just felt very confused. Andrew, I'll start with you on this because Matt and I were kind of having a little bit of a conversation about this before we started taping. To me, I looked at Get Up as saying, okay, I like Mike Greenberg. I really like Michelle Beadle and I really like Jalen Rose. I like all of them together and I think they can all be successful together. The problem that I saw was that the amount of hype and emphasis that ESPN put on this show from the very beginning and immediately putting it on ESPN without them having a whole lot of practice to get themselves going and completely changing the traditional SportsCenter in the morning role and Mike and Mike on ESPN too. It almost seems like they were trying to do too much too fast versus if you would have just let Get Up start up on ESPN too, let them work out some of the kinks, let them figure out their voices and what the show was really going to be. The pressure would have been less. The expectations wouldn't have been as high. And I think they could have really built something from not having to have to deliver immediately. And the conversation, I think, around it would have been different. What are you guys seeing or what have you seen from Get Up that either you've liked or you've disliked so far?
I mean, I'd agree with you there, Ben. I think it probably would have been easier for the show if it had started with smaller expectations, start on ESPN2. But I think that the reason that happened was because of larger things going on around it. This was the big thing that ESPN sold advertisers on at their upfronts last year. This was what they were trying to do to shape the narrative of, this is ESPN going forward, that we're emphasizing these personalities, we're getting this whole new studio in New York. And when you talk about the resources they're putting into this in particular, of relocating three very highly paid hosts and a number of other people, getting these giant new studios, changing where things like NBA Countdown are shot as a result of this, I don't think you can justify doing that for an ESPN2 show. And so, and that's in a lot of ways, I mean, and that's the problem that Get Up is facing in general, I think, is that it's limited in what it can actually be. It's something airing from 7 to 10 in the morning Eastern. I mean, whole swaths of the country aren't even out of bed yet, and people aren't going to really heavily record a live talk show and watch that later. I think it's limited by, I mean, there's a whole lot of limiting factors there beyond the time slot. There's what these people can talk about. I mean, it's not going to be First Take. It's not going to be debate. It's these people sitting around and having conversations about sports, and it's essential. It's morning talk meets a bit of a sports thing, and that's fine and well and good and all that. And I think from everything we've seen so far, it's a perfectly fine show. But there's been so much effort to, there's been so much talk about this and so much effort to try and pump this up as like, this is the future of ESPN. And I think that's something that's going to be very hard for this show ever to live up to. I mean, I think it's a perfectly fine piece of content. It doesn't need a year plus of discussion promoting it. It doesn't need all the attention that's been placed on it, but ESPN's done that because they have to have something to sell.
I'm going to say something I never thought I would say publicly, and it's these five words. I agreed with Clay Travis because they cut through all of the noise, and he wrote about this and some of the issues with it, and just this one point. I mean, nothing else. But I think what he said was really interesting because here you have ESPN. You have a very successful show in Mike and Mike. Maybe not everyone's cup of tea, but highly successful, makes a ton of money, very inoffensive, maybe to a fault.
Right.
I mean, you know, my mother and dad would sit down and watch Mike and Mike in the morning. I mean, who cares? It's fun, whatever. And what you've done as ESPN is now you've broken up your most successful radio show. You have now a radio show that isn't as good with Golic and Wingo, doesn't have the same chemistry, the same history, the same brand recognition, whatever. You've got a show on ESPN where you're paying the talent on the show millions upon millions of dollars, and they're delivering worse ratings than just the generic stuff that was on before. And is that not what we get on Fox Sports 1 about? I mean, that they pay these absurd salaries to Cowherd and Whitlock and Bayless and all of those guys, and yet they deliver minuscule viewers. I mean, it's the same thing here, where you're paying these exorbitant salaries, all of this hype, and you're just not getting the goods being delivered from a viewership standpoint. So now you've made both ESPN and ESPN2 worse in the morning. You have this narrative that has been built up over a year against the show. I mean, I cannot think of a show that suffered from more self-inflicted damage than this Get Up show, because it had been so hyped up for a year, because you have the bad feelings coming out of the Mike and Mike breakup. Mm-hmm. You had the silly narrative about woke center or whatever that just stirred the pot even more, just totally unnecessarily. Like, there have been so many things working against this show from the start. I don't know how it does succeed. And to your point, Ben, I mean, if this had just launched with such little fanfare, I go back to the days of Cold Pizza when it started with its innocent beginnings before it morphed into Frankenstein's monster that is First Take. Like, if you just take that trajectory, it's fine. But ESPN decided to build up all of these expectations, decided to break up Mike and Mike. The salaries are made public. The narratives get twisted around. And it is just one big quagmire that I'm not sure, at least, especially in the short term, I'm not sure how this show reverses that at the moment.
I think once people sort of become accustomed to it, I don't know if they'll necessarily generate a rating spike. But I do think ESPN is committed to its run long term. I mean, they have to be. With the amount of money that's being paid, they have to be committed to a long term run. And like you said, they're intriguing personalities, and I feel like all three guys are easy to get behind. At least from my personal perspective, because I enjoy all of them on an individual level, and I think Beadle and Jalen Rose together in NBA coverage has been terrific. But I think you're right in the sense of how everything was set up, how it was brought together, and the narrative that was created behind it caused a lot of concern. So I'm very curious to see how it ultimately goes. And that will do it. That's another edition of our Awful Announcing Roundtable. It is presented by Clip It. You can download the Clip It app today over on Android and on iOS. For Andrew, for Matt, this is Ben. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back soon with another edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Until then, so long.